Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%. If this is the first time you're tuning in, a quick overview. This podcast is all about creative roles and opportunities, and born out of the statistic I heard at the Creative Equals Create Your Future event in May 2018, which was that only 11% of women are creative directors within the media industry. As an artist and creative director myself, I felt compelled to take action to do something that pushes that percentage a lot higher. It occurred to me when thinking about what that action could be is that there's a lot of careers that I have absolutely no idea what they are and what skills they require. So the possibility to inhabit or inspire to have those roles can never eventuate. And that is even before entering the battleground of opportunity. As I'm super interested in how others shape their creativity, I'll be chatting to a range of women over the series, exploring their careers and their creative lives, in the aim to expand the knowledge of the vast number of options available for pursuing a creative career, in addition to shedding some light on what others do. Welcome to episode 7. This week I'm joined by the multi-talented Astrid Goldsmith, an award-winning animator specialising primarily in puppet stop motion. You'll be familiar with Astrid's work having seen her models and puppets in well-known adverts such as The Elephant for Ford Fiesta, The Duracell Bunny, and a very recent addition, The Troll, in Nike's Never Ask campaign. She has also contributed to films, Making Vibrating Slugs for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and Human Puppets and a Terrifying Shark for the Pivot's Gory in the Blood music video. She made a paper-cut stop-motion film titled Imagination for Channel 4's Random Acts. She spent 8 years independently making Squirrel Island, a beautiful film that you can't tear your eyes from, as every frame has been intelligently and lovingly crafted. This involved writing, making all the puppets, directing and shooting the film herself. Squirrel Island has gone on to be screened at over 30 festivals and has won numerous awards. She has recently been commissioned by the BFI and BBC4 Animation 2018, which has resulted in her producing Quarantine, a film about badgers and Brexit, which is being premiered on the 19th of November at the BFI South Bank. Astrid, it's with great excitement, and I'm sure you can hear it in my voice, to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Thanks, it's great to be here.
So, can we kick off with you telling me what you do as a director slash model maker?
Sure. So, in short form animation, as well as kind of commercial freelancing, a lot of those job titles kind of blur together. Mm-hmm. So I always feel slightly fraudulent calling myself a director because it's, you know, I'm a animator, model maker, designer, director. Director comes last. Director's just, you know, incidental. Like, I, you know. as a model maker, commercially, I make mainly puppets and characters. Mm-hmm. I have done some sort of special effects and props and sets work before, mm-hmm. but I mainly now just do puppets and characters for film and TV and adverts and music videos and things. And then my directing work is quite separate to that because that's my own writing, my own creations. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is where the directing comes in, because where you say it's like kind of incidental, it's not really, because it's like the overarching vision which you then set out and make.
Yeah.
Which includes making the puppet.
Yes. I see it more as I'm a writer, mm-hmm. creator. It's just one of those things. I'm sure we're going to come back to this many times, but, you know, when you have kind of imposter syndrome, and when you're self-taught, and when you come into something mm-hmm. At a bit of a sideways angle, you sort of never really feel like you can, you know, you've earned the title, of director. But yes, I mean, I am a director.
You definitely are a director.
I definitely am. Thanks,
you
Sammy.
You can be imposter syndrome all you want. You're definitely a director. I mean, we'll get to Squirrel Island, but yeah. You can't watch Squirrel Island and not call yourself a director.
Yeah. I think because the way I see it, I write films and I design films and I know how I want them to look, mm-hmm. and then I kind of, and then everything else is just, you know, a natural progression mm-hmm. of that one impulse, which I sort of see more as like a writer-artist impulse. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Rather than a kind of film director. But yes, you're right, I am.
Yeah, and I definitely see that. You know, like, my own artistic endeavours, I really see, like, you are doing everything, but the umbrella is you are directing. You're, like, driving whatever happens.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
So, tell me, where does model making fit in the creative industries? Because, yeah, you're kind of covering a lot of things here, like we said, like adverts, you know, music videos.
Yeah, and that, yeah, that's kind of one of the greatest things about being a model maker, and also a bit of a curse, because people really like you to specialise and they really just really want to put you in a box all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of feel like the whole film industry is a bit like that as well. Whereas I think with model makers, it's basically, if you can make something, then you can pretty much learn to make something else. And a lot of creative processes are kind of, they follow very similar paths. So if you know how to make moulds for slip casting for ceramic, then you'll also know how to make a mould for making like a puppet head or, you know. So I think, you know, actually once you learn how to make one thing, then you can just take on, you know, all sorts of things. So yeah, model making fits into the creative industries in many, many different ways. So I have friends who are model makers who just do shop windows, so just display. Or there are some model makers, which is the dream, who just do like theme parks.
Wow.
Like all the kind of fiberglass rocks.
So quite big. So,
yeah, huge, yeah. But I've always preferred to work smaller, so... I work much more frequently in animation, obviously, stop motion. But I have also done kind of horror special effects and, you know, things for things that don't move. So things that for photography campaigns.
I'm curious, what drew you to model making in the first instance? Because we've got two of your models here in the studio, the gorgeous squirrel and a badger, which are just little personalities in their own right. Which I can see why you can be drawn to be like, wow, I'd like to make something like that. But yeah, it's quite a focused and dedicated practice.
Yeah, I started making things when I was really small. So I used to have really bad, I can't believe I'm talking about this, but I used to have really bad tantrums when I was 3 or 4. My parents discovered that one of the only ways to kind of really calm me down was to get me to make things, because then my, you know, focus was kind of really, you know, only on this one thing, and I would just become extremely calm and focused. I still feel like that now. I mean, I don't throw tantrums, or, you know, not as regularly, but even now, if I'm having a stressful day and then I'll start sculpting something, I can just feel my heart rate go down. I just feel super calm and yeah. Wow. So, I started when I was 4, making polymer clay models. So I used to make loads of like Disney characters and stuff from history, like Elizabeth II, some suffragettes. Yeah. Got some suffragettes chained to some railings that I made when I was 7.
What I love is either your parents are awesome or you were very inquisitive. So how did you know about the suffragettes when you were 7?
We had this really amazing book on the suffragist movement, a picture book, really beautiful. I think it was made in the 70s. I mean, there was no TV at home. We didn't have a TV. Okay. We just had loads of books. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, my parents definitely had an amazing book collection.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that kind of really inspired me. I've always made that kind of thing, like models. And then when I was about 11, I saw Nick Park's A Grand Day Out, the first Wallace and Gromit film. And I just really loved it. I loved the kind of weird oven character they find on the moon. And I just really wanted to do that. So yeah, my parents got me a Super 8 camera, just set up in my bedroom with cardboard box sets and anglepoise lamps, and just made some like plasticine films.
That's amazing. And so when did you get the Super 8 camera, like roughly?
I think it was my 12th birthday.
Yeah.
I think.
Which was roughly what year? I don't want to age
you. Oh, right.
But I'm curious is, was it like video around then? Did they get
oh,
you?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so that was, hang on, probably 92, 93.
Okay, so yeah.
So definitely video was around, but obviously we didn't have a TV, so there was nothing to plug the video camera into.
Yeah.
And, you know, our whole household was quite kind of analogue.
Mm-hmm. Which has paid off in dividends, looking at your creativity.
So it just seemed completely natural to me. Yeah. And I think, and so I just started. And also, so exciting. I mean, I obviously didn't know anything different. Like, this was just the way you made films,
yeah. You
know. But it is really exciting. At that point, you sent off... You got a prepaid envelope.
Yeah.
Do they still do this?
No, they don't. I mean, Kodak has bought back Super 8. So, yeah, it kind of ended, I'd say, about 6 years ago now.
Okay.
And now they've started bringing it back in a more retro model. It's like, and it's also got a chip in it, so you can have a digital copy. And
ooh.
Yeah, exactly. but, yeah, they stopped the yellow envelope that used to go off to Switzerland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the Netherlands, maybe.
Oh, maybe it was the Netherlands, yeah.
But, yeah, and then you'd wait, like, a month.
Yeah.
And then it would... come in, you know, onto your doormat. So exciting.
I still have a pile of those.
Yeah.
And I love those envelopes because they had the little pin that you put.
Yes.
Saying it.
Yeah. Split pin.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So exciting.
Wow. So your kind of creativity was really nurtured. Like, you know, how fantastic your parents worked out how to hone your creativity, etc. And then you've just kind of developed it over time. I find it really interesting when you say you come from left field because you've been model making and creating pretty much from 3 or 4 years old, which is... Yeah, not coming from left field at all. It's, like, fairly established.
No, I know. And I think, you know, this is the curse of having bad teachers. So when I, at school, my, you know, when I did GCSE art and my art teachers really didn't like me and predicted me really low grades and basically discouraged me from pursuing it, didn't want me to do art A-level.
Yeah.
And so I just sort of thought, oh, I'm not... good at this, and this is just some weird thing I do on my own.
Yeah.
So I learned at quite a young age to sort of protect myself and to kind of, you know, not, you know, just and not see what I did as, you know, having kind of artistic value. And then, so then I did an academic degree, and then only after that I went to art school because I just thought it wasn't for me. But I think coming to it so late, I've always felt like I didn't follow the kind of correct path,
yeah.
You know, because I didn't go to film school
yeah.
and I didn't do an art degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's sort of, I think, and also if I'd sort of chosen more carefully, especially at MA level, you know, because now with hindsight, I realise that actually it's most beneficial to go to a really good school to do an MA.
Mm-hmm.
And you get, you know, if you go somewhere for animation, if you go somewhere like the Royal College or NFTS, then you have this amazing network of people that can like really push you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I probably would have got my career on track much faster if I'd thought about that. Yeah.
What is on track? Like, I often question that myself, you know. I think, especially as creative people and artists, like, we're constantly thinking, you know, am I going the right direction? Because it's a lot of things about, I need to feed myself, I need to pay the rent, and I need to make my work. So I think that question is constantly there, but you're probably on the right track anyway. It's just all the other outside things that you have to deal with.
Totally. And I think, actually, more than anything, on the right track means affirmation.
Mm.
And it just means... what it would probably have meant is that I would have gone into the animation industry very early and got, you know, regular jobs that weren't really the sort of thing I wanted to do anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in a way, I'm very thankful that I didn't do that. And, you know, I just had other kind of weird jobs and then, yeah, made films on the side.
Yeah. And I really like that because your work is very unique. You know, it's very much... you can see it. It feels like your creations, which I really love. And I think, you know, there's many ways to kind of find your creative path. But I think there's something in the fact that sometimes you don't go the route that's predicted or expected. And it creates, like, delightful results. All right. So talking about model making and the genre of animation, you know, models used to make up predominantly a lot of animation. And now it's, I would say... a lot less, just because of digital. So can you explain the process of making a model how you make the model and then how you go on to animate it.
Sure. So, I mean, I think that actually at the moment, you're totally right in that special effects used to be predominantly model animation. Mm-hmm. And now it's 99% digital. I can't even think of a special effect. Actually, they did a tiny bit of Jurassic Park, the most recent Jurassic Park film, mm-hmm. with... Anyway, with like real world models. But yeah, and I think the invention of the 3D printer has had a massive impact on stop motion animation. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think we're kind of living through a bit of a boom period of stop motion, seeing as, you know, you've got Leica and Aardman, mm-hmm. You know, making these amazing... And Wes Anderson,
yes,
all making amazing stop motion feature films, which are basically keeping the world's stop motion animators in business, because yeah. they're like 5-year projects, yeah. that, you know, they just go from one to the next. And I think I can definitely explain to you my process, mm-hmm. of model making, but for puppets in stop motion, but mm-hmm. it really varies, and I think particularly with 3D printing now. Mm-hmm. Now you can just print off a million faces and, mm-hmm. you know, sort them out. So my puppets, so the squirrel here is...
I should say you're looking at the squirrel.
I am. I'm pointing at a squirrel. I'm not calling you a squirrel, Renee. The squirrel is quite a few years old now. And I've actually changed my... process since Squirrel Island, mm-hmm. To make it more environmentally friendly. So with the squirrel, I would sculpt in clay the body and the head, mm-hmm. make molds, cast the body and the tail in a kind of flexible polyurethane foam, mm-hmm. And the head in a hard polyurethane resin, and then I'd make a wire and brass, like an aluminium wire and brass armature. Mm-hmm. Which is like the skeleton that goes inside. I'd glue that into the body. And then, you know, paint and then make fabric for the covering and make the clothes and blah, blah, blah. And lots of other processes in between that. But I kind of got very aware towards the end of Squirrel Island about my impact, the impact I was having, and just our industry in general was having.
On the environment, you mean?
On the environment, yeah. And also on my body, mm-hmm. Because all of those chemicals are really toxic and horrible. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to work in a bit more of a friendly way, so a lower impact on both my health and the environment. Mm-hmm. So definitely with quarantine, I eliminated sculpting and moulding, casting. With the badgers, their heads are balsa wood, so super light. And so that's just directly carved, and then the body is furnishing foam, just snip it into shape. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the process is quite similar, so wire armature, glued in, and then a fabric covering. And I think, you know, there are drawbacks to that, so you don't... with moulds, you can knock out as many puppets as you want. Mm-hmm. So I had two of the main grey squirrel character in Squirrel Island. I had... millions of acorns. I could make, like, all of the red squirrels in Squirrel Island were identical, mm-hmm. to have that kind of military style, yeah. feel. And so I could just, you know, cast repeatedly. Obviously, you can't do that with a direct carving, snipping process. Yeah. I think it works for quarantine because I had a very limited time to do it, and I just thought, if puppets break, I'm just going to have to deal with it. Yeah. It's a very lo-fi, low-cost technique.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about Squirrel Island and quarantine. So maybe we could have like a quick discussion, like an overview of what they are. And then I'd like to ask you then how you go on to, once you've made the models or the puppets, how you go on to animate them.
Sure. So which one do you want to start with?
Let's start with Squirrel Island.
Okay.
Because I haven't seen, obviously, Quarantine yet, because it's yet to be premiered.
Yeah.
But Squirrel Island, I'm in love with. Like, I think it is the most gorgeous film. I've watched it several times now, and, yeah, like, talk about a labour of love. It took you 8 years to make, which I am so in admiration of, because, like, I've read an article on you talking about you just fitted it in around other jobs, you needed to then get some money in, you self-funded it. Like, yeah, what a feat. It is so beautiful.
Thank you so much. It really means a lot. Because I think, you know, that those sort of things, when you work for such a long time by yourself, you just think, like, all the time I just think, you know, because you just do the work, you've got your head down, you do the work, but then every now and again you just think, is this going to mean anything to anyone else? You know, is it going to make sense to anyone else? Yeah. And so it's always just really special to hear that other people like it.
It's awesome. I just think it's such a beautiful piece of work. Artwork, you know, and the thought and the writing, I think, is incredible. And there's so much humour in it, but also, like, there's this underlying message that's slowly seeping up that isn't in your face. Like, I just think it's so intelligent and so sensitive.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I was trying to kind of bury the message a bit, because I, you know, I really hate it when films like that, you know, like, really hit you over the head with the message. But, so I'll just say briefly, Squirrel Island is a 21-minute sci-fi action thriller about squirrel apartheid. It's basically greys versus reds, and a lot of it is based on fact. So we have eliminated the grey squirrel population from the south coast islands of Britain in order to let the red squirrels live. And so I just sort of wanted to... This always just seems really crazy and weird and creepy to me, that we kind of make these sort of terrible decisions about other species and then just, you know, execute them, literally. And when it's all, you know, a problem entirely of our own making. So, yeah, and to me, there were sort of some subtle parallels with the immigration situation in this country, and I kind of wanted to say something gently, just put my voice out there against the kind of tide of ugly anti-immigration rhetoric. But it got released, so I started writing in 2008, and then I finally finished it, and it got released in 2016, which is kind of the peak of what people refer to as the migrant crisis, but definitely all of those stories where people were coming on boats, people, you know, being drowned at sea, terrible, terrible stories, that all kind of reached its peak in 2016. So what I found was Squirrel Island was being programmed in kind of immigration-themed programmes at film festivals, you know, alongside other much more kind of heavy-hitting...
documentaries, yeah.
And so the message, did seem much more... it kind of got pulled out of it much more than I'd originally intended, but I think that's fine, you know.
But look, the message is there, but it's subtle, and it's like you said, you're not beating anyone over the head. But what it is, it's an awareness. Like, as I watched it, like, I was purely watching it for its craft in the beginning. Like, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. How's she done that? And then, you know, the story starts seeping into you and you're like, oh yeah. So I think that's like, and that's what I think is brilliant writing, where you have your own awareness rather than being told.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, it's, you know, it's a film about evil squirrels.
Yeah, the one that's here has got a knife, a dagger in her hand.
Yeah. I mean, it's not her fault, you know. Yeah. She's a product of her society.
That is true.
She's just following orders, just an obedient squirrel following orders. But, yeah, so that's... That's Squirrel Island. What else did you want to know?
Quarantine.
Oh, Quarantine. Yeah, so Quarantine is a 12-minute post-Brexit pagan dance fantasy about a group of Morris dancing badgers who live in the shadow of an animal quarantine facility on the south coast of England. And they're kind of trying to ignore the... inmates. They're kind of trying to ignore the plight of the quarantined animals and just get on with their own lives, and they're sort of desperately trying to maintain their traditions, mm-hmm. their folk traditions, until one day tragedy strikes and they need to seek help elsewhere.
I'm very much looking forward to seeing this film. And I should say, like, you've just come off the back of finishing this film in a huge push. We were talking before we started recording that you kind of work 71 days straight, 15-hour days.
Yeah, well, that was just shooting. Yeah. So, yeah, 71 shoot days, 15-hour days, which just felt really crazy. But then before that, I was also manically writing, drawing. So I drew 300 storyboard panels in 5 days.
Oh my God.
Really insane. I mean, bearing in mind that storyboarding Squirrel Island, which is, you know, not that much longer actually, took 3 months. Mm. And they're beautiful, like colour, mm-hmm. story colour panels. So this was very quick. So I was writing, storyboarding, and building puppets and sets. Kind of the month before that, and then got into shooting.
So 4 months, just over 4 months in total.
Yeah.
So you need a holiday now.
Yeah.
you're in quarantine.
No, it's fine. I've actually just had a holiday. Okay. I went to exile myself to a field in Yorkshire for a week. And it's so weird. I felt so burnt out by the end of it. Mm-hmm. I went away. As soon as I was in a field, I was like, thinking of my next film. Yeah. Just so excited. Yeah. And now I've come back and I've started researching it. I'm so excited about it.
Oh, incredible. Okay, so you require such a broad skill set. Like, that is evident. If you watch Squirrel Island, knowing that you've done it, you know, it yourself. So you work, like, as you said, in sculpting, you know, lighting a set, thinking about Foley, writing. So, like, for me, you're in an ongoing process of development, depending on what you're working on, what you're coming up with, your own kind of ideas. So how do you factor development into your practice?
Do you mean development of skills or development of ideas?
So, well, probably both. So let's think about maybe skills, because I think you probably have ideas. And then it will be like, well, how am I going to make this? And that's what I'm curious about, because I think you set out on creative quests where you might not have any idea how it's going to come together. And I'm really curious because you are like multi-skilled and constantly upskilling.
I think even though it's probably not true, in my head, I always think if I'd gone to film school, I'd just know how to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I just think, oh, I'll just teach myself. And so when I mean, basically it all comes from just having an idea. So you have an idea, you write it down, you storyboard it. And when I storyboard, I don't ever think about how I'm going to make something. Mm-hmm. I just think about what would serve the story. I just think about what would be really fun to see, mm-hmm. and what I'd kind of love to make or be excited to have on screen. And then some elements of that absolutely terrify me and I just don't want to deal with them, and then you get to the point in the shoot where you're like, this is what I've got to shoot next, I'm going to have to learn how to do this. And you just learn. I mean, yeah, so I think it's that to me is really exciting, and it's also that kind of amazing buzz you get from learning. It's just really fun to like work that into your projects. I'm not saying that it's just, you know, it's all like just a fun walk in the park. It's really stressful. It's so stressful, especially when you've got so little time.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you're not challenging yourself, then you're not learning, and you might as well be dead. So
the extreme version of that, isn't it?
Well, no,
there is a middle ground.
Is there? No. I think, like, for example, with Squirrel Island, the whole way through. So at the end, there's a kind of fight scene on a boat, mm-hmm. They chuck a poison acorn and it explodes. And in stop motion, water, explosions and fire are just complete no-nos, basically. People are like, just avoid it, just avoid it. Mm-hmm. And so for ages, I was like, for years, I would look at that part of my storyboard, I'd be like, oh, I don't want to deal with that. But actually, when it got to it, you just think, okay, I'm going to order a load of smoke bombs,
yeah.
And I'm going to order some of that, like, reflective tape that cyclists use.
I'm just laughing at myself. You're like, you order a load of smoke bombs, and I go, yeah. Like, that's something you do every day.
Well, no, I've never ordered smoke bombs before, but they're really fun. Yeah. I'd ordered, like, some of that tape, the reflective tape that cyclists use. So I'd read that if you shine a direct light on that, then you get a really good, like, you know, glare for the camera. And then I just spent a really crazy day just setting fire to my set, basically, over and over again, because obviously you light a smoke bomb, you take two frames, then you might get another, like, pose in and the smoke bomb's still burning, but more than likely you have to light another one. So, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I think actually the commercial side of my practice really helps with that. It really feeds into that. So the Nike advert I did just before quarantine, that was actually the first time I'd ever shot with green screen. Mm-hmm. So normally I do everything in camera. Yep. But yeah, that was the first time. And, you know, again, it's like, I didn't know how to light it. I didn't know, you know, but you just do some research and, like, you know, buy some green screen paint and look up some tutorials online and then, you know, just, yeah.
So how do you do that research, though?
I mean, mainly Google is my friend.
Yeah. Google's everyone's friend.
But also asking friends. Mm-hmm. Asking for help. I mean, especially, you know, with stuff that I don't actually know that many other stop motion animators, but I do know a lot of cinematographers and other filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, they will always, you know, give me some tips if I ask them. It's just asking for help and just Google mainly, and also kind of old books. Sometimes, because I'm shooting in such a weird old-fashioned way, a lot of it is in camera. A lot of the time you get, you know, really old special effects books and things like that where you find at car boot sales. Like, you often get some good tips.
So I'm going to retrace our steps because we actually didn't answer one of the questions.
Okay.
Which ties in nicely with, so you still work in celluloid film, shooting on my beloved camera, obviously yours as well, the Bolex. So why are you using the Bolex and celluloid film as opposed to digital? And the other element is, like, how do you animate? How do you stop motion?
Okay.
Like, yeah. We explained Squirrel Island and quarantine, but we didn't talk about then how you animate the models.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. I mean, there's obviously lots of different elements to animating. I mean, really, it is literally just you move something a bit and then you take a frame. But then, you know, there's also lots of other things, like you act out the... So before you even start, I like to act out the movement myself in my studio. Mm-hmm. I do that a few times, so kind of work out how it gets there. Lots of animators film themselves doing that so they can base the movement on their actual movement. I don't do that, I mean, purely because it's just extra time. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to look at loads of weird videos of myself opening doors and things.
Reacting to explosions.
Yeah. And also, I'm not so concerned with capturing sort of super realistic human movement. I think there's something quite weird and funny about, you know, something that's not really animal, not really human, but, you know, a new type of movement. So I act it out. I think about anticipation and reaction times because they're kind of important. How far something will go. So sometimes you shoot on twos, like two frames per movement. And sometimes if there's fast things like blinking or things flying through the air, you shoot those on ones, or close-ups are shot on ones normally. And yeah, just keep going until you you finish. But yeah, I mean, actually going back to the first part of that question about celluloid, obviously the reason I started shooting on film was because that's what I had access to.
Your Super 8 camera,
And then the reason that I continued to shoot on film was basically because that's what I had access to. Mm-hmm. So I shot a 16mm film at university because that's what they offered. And then after that, I really wanted to make a film. Like, when I was thinking about Squirrel Island before I even started writing it. I knew that I really wanted to make a film, but I had no idea of how I'd do that. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any equipment. And I, you know, it just seemed so kind of, it seemed such a massive mountain to climb. And then my friend Alex Smith, who's a director who I used to work with a lot making models, mm-hmm. he did the pivot video that you mentioned earlier. Yeah.
Which is ridiculously gory.
It's great though. Yeah. He showed me this really amazing film called Blood, Tea and Red String, mm-hmm. which is an hour-long stop motion, silent stop motion, by a filmmaker called Christiane Sagafsky. Mm-hmm. It's really incredible. And there was, I don't know whether we found this or whether it was on the DVD, but there's a little making of featurette where you, and she made this film on her own for 13 years.
Oh my gosh.
And she moved house, I don't know, six times, yeah. seven times. And you get to see her kind of filming it. And she shot it all with a Bolex. And I watched that and I just thought, oh yeah, I could do that. She's done it, I can do that. Where you lead, I will follow. Yeah. So yeah, that it just sort of seemed like possible. That was possible okay. to me. That's the very basic reason. Mm-hmm. Obviously, beyond that, you know, I love the design and the feel and the texture of the actual camera. I love the look of film, the colours. As an animator, I really love the type of performance it elicits. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to hold it all in your head and just go for it. Whereas now I shot Quarantine with a digital camera and Dragon Frame, which is a motion capture software. Mm-hmm. And that's great because you can see your progress and you can delete frames mm-hmm. and kind of change it as you go back and, you know, all of that stuff. But it really changes the animation. I found it really, really hard to deal with at first. It took me, I'd say, several weeks into Quarantine mm-hmm. to actually kind of get to grips with it, because it's, for me, it just kind of ruins the acting part of the process, and it ruins your focus and your concentration mm-hmm. because so much of the time your hands are on the puppet, but you're looking at the screen, mm-hmm. so you're not looking at the puppet, which yeah. is, it's a weird kind of disconnect.
Yeah.
But yeah, sort of, I've kind of got to grips with it a bit more yeah. now. But I do, yeah, I think if I could afford the film and the processing, I would still be shooting on film.
Mm.
It's got a bit prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, well, let's hope that changes.
Yeah, I'd certainly hope yeah. so.
Can you tell me what has been one of the biggest challenges in your career?
I would say the biggest challenge is myself. I mean, it is going back to what we were talking about earlier about yeah. imposter syndrome. And I think, you know, that infects everything. Mm. You know, it definitely affects how you make films, the kind of films you make, the format that you make them on, you know, the way you make them, who you would want to involve with making them. And it also involves, you know, how you promote them as well. Because, I mean, I don't know how much affirmation it's going to take for me to feel like, yeah, okay, I'm here, I'm doing some films. But, yeah, I think that's probably, it's a big challenge. And I think you just have to, like, steamroller over those feelings a lot of the time and just get it done.
Yeah.
I think it also, you know, if I'm thinking about external challenges, it also just always comes back to that. Like, external challenges, like working in a workplace with loads of misogynists, you know, where you just think, if I didn't feel like such an imposter, I would definitely be stronger in this environment mm-hmm. or, you know, not stand for it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think, I mean, there's always lots and lots of physical challenges mm-hmm. when you're working with physical materials.
Yeah.
And learning new processes and you know, messing up and getting stuff wrong. But I'd say, like, overall, it's, yeah.
It's weird, because, I mean, I'm sitting here listening to you. Obviously, imposter syndrome is real. You know, I feel it from time to time as well. Probably a lot of time from time to time. But, you know, like, Squirrel Island in its own right, like, as I've keep saying, is absolutely incredible film. You know, the work that you've done on other models, other projects that you've worked on, you know, you've just been commissioned by the BFI and the BBC for, you know, Animation 2018. You know, your work is fantastic. And it's like, I'd say it's painful hearing that, you know, you feel like things that are holding you back sometimes is your imposter syndrome, because you've also just explained to me that, oh, if I don't know how to do something, I just learn it. So what I love is, you know, that's there, but you're, like you said, you're steamrolling over it.
Yeah.
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 And I'm not going to obviously make you feel affirmed today, but I will just keep saying it, because I think you're so fantastically creative and I love the work you do. And, you know, Squirrel Island's won loads of awards.
Yeah, no, I know. And that's great. That is great. And I'm not, you know, I'm definitely not kind of asking you to tell me how great I am.
Of course you're not.
It's so really embarrassing. But I think it's, I'm just being honest. Like, that is definitely the biggest challenge I face. And it is, yeah, like you know, I know that everyone feels like that, you know, some more than others, some more frequently than others. And it is, I mean, the second part of that question is like, how do you cope with that? I just used to kind of have to ignore it, like ignore that voice in your head. But I'm still kind of learning to, you know, find ways to ignore it.
Yeah.
But I think also just, you know, I think basically if you, you know, if I like the work I make, then I'm happy.
Yeah.
I mean, in that sense, affirmation is great, but there will never be enough affirmation ever for anyone.
Yeah.
So for me, as long as I like what I'm doing, then it's okay.
Which is kind of goes full circle back to where we kind of started off, because that means that you're on the right path, I think. But anyway, I think it's a great segue for us to go into then. What advice would you give to someone wanting to be a model maker / director, animator?
I would say just keep making stuff, whether that's models or films or whatever. You know, don't wait around for a certain portion of money or other people to work with or whatever. You know, because actually those pieces might never be in the right place at the right time. I think you just have to make what you can make within your means. I would say, So after I graduated from my MA in animation, I stopped animating for about 7 years and was just a commercial model maker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I had made my own work in that time, I probably would have been happier. So I think, I think just keep making your own work, even if it's in quite a kind of small way.
Great. So, I know that obviously you've got the premiere of Quarantine coming up on the 19th of November at BFI Southbank. What else have you got in the mix? Seeing you went away to Yorkshire and you're already thinking of ideas.
Yeah. So I'm now in my favourite part of the creative process, which is research and development.
Anything's possible.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I love about that.
Anything's possible. Yeah. And also you get to do this kind of great like filtering system of just reading loads of like new books, going to see like new museums and galleries, watching new films, you know, like gaining as much kind of cultural intelligence as possible in order for that to kind of filter through into new work. It's just a brilliant, optimistic, fun time. So I'm writing my new film. Researching it. I might have another project kind of in the works. I'm waiting to hear about that, which will be more of a kind of arts, like participatory arts project, I think. That's kind of coming up.
Okay, cool. Well, I could keep talking forever, but I'm going to wrap up with something I always do at the end of every episode. I'm wondering if you can tell me about a career or job that you've always been interested in but you don't know very much about, and that way I might be able to get someone in that role on the podcast, but also someone within the creative industries, a woman who you'd love to hear on Greater Than Love.
Sure. So I'm really curious about the process of sound designers. So I don't really know anything about it. I've obviously worked with a couple of sound designers, but it's always seemed a very kind of remote process to my work. So I'd really like to learn kind of what's involved and also how best to communicate with them. I'm not that they're another species, but, you know, because I'm purely visual
process.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like I can hear the things in my head of like how they want to sound, but then, you know, the best way to communicate that to somebody else would be really useful to know.
Okay, awesome.
And your second question, so it's a very different role. It's the other side of the industry. It's exhibition side of the industry. Uh-huh. But Gemma Desai, who is, she works for the British Council Film Department, and she also is an independent programmer for LFF. And she runs her own amazing screening series called I Am Dora. It's basically about kind of like how women communicate with each other and the impact they have on one another. But yeah, I think, yeah, that's she's kind of an amazing programmer. Curator.
I've never heard of her, so that's fantastic. Yeah, definitely reach out to her. Astrid, it has been so lovely talking to you. I love that you've brought in the puppets. Definitely going to grab some photos of those. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh my God, you're so inspiring. I was like going to go on a big rant. They're like, oh my God, I find you so inspiring. I was like, no, enough. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.